This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 16th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting to you this week from Phoenix, the day after tax season ends. Hopefully you all made it through in one piece. You all are now calmed down, relaxing. We're bringing this up after the 15th simply because a couple of reasons. One key one, which I will be very honest about, is that, of course, it was the last week of tax season. I have a practice, and there were various things that needed to be done with a deadline of April 15th, and there just wasn't going to be time to get this in during that time frame, get prepared, etc. It's also going to be a little different this week, because instead of going through what happened in the past week, we'll talk about and we'll catch up on that information next week. We'll basically deal with the 2 weeks' issues. We're going to rather kind of take a look at the state of where we're at under our new tax bill, which is, where are we at here? Having gone through one tax season of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, grit your teeth, go forward, and have at it. Well, now we're here at the end of tax season. And it's probably a good time, since everybody got ramped up. We've been all into preparing. We remember when we first, last time we kind of looked around, probably we had just gotten the final regulations on 199 Cap A, and then the deluge began. And so all the returns moving, everything started happening. It was putting things together, trying to get things taken care of, getting all the documents. And so all that stuff that's part of tax season took over. So what we want to try to review here is step back and figure out, where are we at right now with the guidance on the law that was passed in December of 2017? What's still to become? What areas do we still have issues in? Just kind of, you know, remind ourselves where we're at coming into this year, because a whole bunch of things are going to be happening, because we clearly are not done with the guidance here on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. When the bill came out, the IRS announced fairly early that it would take 18 months to get reasonably full guidance out on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And their goal primarily there was to get guidance out in the form of regulations that we would have. Well, or at least it's kind of morphed into that by now, because the IRS in the interim has also told us they're going to try to avoid the use of subrogatory guidance. So we had 18 months with regs, and there's a reason for that 18-month rule. A, there was a lot of information in the bill, but B, legally, there's an issue they've got. Talk about perfect timing. Just this morning, as I was preparing for today's session, I get every morning the morning tax report from Politico, comes into my mailbox, which is actually a very useful source of information about things that are happening in the tax world. It's very, you know, it's from a technical standpoint, much better, let's say, in fact, way better than your average, popular press coverage of tax issues. So it's a very technical coverage, and it deals with some of the key issues. And one of the key nuts and bolts issues they brought up today was that Treasury is facing a June 22nd deadline to get regulations out, if those regulations are meant to take effect and govern activities going back to the date the bill, the date that basically the president signed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act into law in December of 2017. They have 18 months to get it done. Bingo, the 18 months ends on June the 22nd, because as I recall, the bill was signed on December 23rd. So 18 months, in essence, they have to get it before the 18-month period is over. So June 22nd is the date that all guidance needs to be published. That would be retroactive to the first date. And that means getting to final regulations. So what's going to be kind of obvious as we review stuff here is some of this is not going to get the final regulations by that date. Number two, as you may remember, everything is going to OIRA these days. And OIRA has up to 45 days to look at regulations unless they are under the special 10-day rule. And we've not seen much come under that special 10-day rule for TCJA issues. This may change, but the idea being, if in fact the regulations will not meet what OIRA believes be the test to be important enough to have the 10-day review rule, then we're starting to run very quickly up on the date for the IRS to be comfortable that the regulations will come back from OIRA in time for the IRS to actually get them issued by June 22nd. They are going to have to get these regs to OIRA here pretty quick, and OIRA may be flooded with regulations here shortly, because the IRS is very much aware of that date, or I should say Treasury is very much aware of that date. What we've had in the past year, we've got a lot of, and this is setting the table for the June 22nd guidance. We have a lot of proposed regulations came in the past year. You know, in certain major areas, we have proposed regs. We'll review where we're sitting on those, and also realize that with the June 22nd date, most likely the IRS is aiming to get the final regs out by that date. So these should be popping up here in the next couple of months. That also could be useful, meaning if you have somebody on extension and, you know, you're waiting to see if, in fact, the final regs make any changes to the treatments of, let's say, something like the 163J interest limitation rules, then yeah, we're going to have, in essence, you would expect we're going to know that, because June 22nd is when we'd expect they'd bring those regs out. So because of that, you know, that gives us some information. We'll take a look. The other catch is, I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, the timing just won't work for anything to come out as proposed regulations today and still be able to meet this June 22nd guidance deadline. So those things that don't have proposed regs out now, basically, you know, the regulations when they come out will have to be prospective in nature. And that does mean that we're going to have kind of an open season under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in those other areas. The IRS also, remember, a few weeks ago, you may not have been paying attention, and so I'll remind you now, but the IRS had a big announcement that they are going to be doing less and less with sub-regulatory guidance. That means things like notices and revenue rulings, that they, you know, they want to try to move away from that and issue most of their official guidance via regulations. Now, the practical reason for that, to be totally honest, I think from a lot of observers believe, is that it appears that the courts are moving away from giving deference to agencies in things that are not issued through the full regulatory process. There's a belief that we may see the Chevron deference rules at least cut back or maybe totally eliminated under the Supreme Court that we have now. And so the belief is that they just might as well get ready for the change to come and realize that they can't issue revenue rulings and notices and things like that and just kind of let them sit there. For those of you who don't know, some of the guidance we have today about whether somebody is covered by a qualified retirement plan, purposes of can they make an IRA contribution that's deductible, that goes back to Notice 8716, which was issued shortly after the Tax Reform Act of 1986. So we've been sitting on that for over 30 years with no regulatory guidance in some of those areas and merely this notice from 30 years ago. Well, that's not going to work this time. We're going to have to go with something different, or the IRS has announced that's where we're going. The end of tax season is a really good time to take a look at where we are. We want to take a look at where we've got mainly complete guidance from the IRS and where we're now going to be moving on to the next phase of having to deal with. So we have our official guidance now. Now we have to look at interpreting that guidance, and we will eventually be looking at court cases to deal with the interpretations there. We have areas of preliminary guidance. Those are the ones that might meet the June 22nd deadline. Some of them are that are in proposed regs. We have some other areas where we just have IRS announcements of what they plan to do. And, you know, they kind of say we don't want to do that as quite as often in the future, but we still have some of those. So we'll talk about where we have prelim guidance and those where we simply don't have anything at all yet, where the guidance has been very, very limited. And so we'll talk about all those things and how they work. Well, if you're like most people, I think, on this broadcast, I think the audience we get here, I realize there may be people here who are sitting in maybe who are in large corporate entities. There may be some other people who are in very specialized stuff in not-for-profits, but probably the largest group listening here this week is going to be in, you know, what we'll say is local and regional CPA firms, probably who are working on privately held companies, most of which are passed through entities of some sort. And so because of that, the big thing, and the IRS recognized this early, was 199 Cap A. Now, the good news there is we mainly have final regulations. The IRS prioritized 199 Cap A, and it's one of the few areas where we have mainly final guidance in place. There's still a couple of things. The proposed regulations came out last summer. Now, remember, if you're using those, because we have an option to use them for 18, you will not have that option for 19. So if you use proposed for 18, you better take a look at how the finals are going to affect 19 returns and warn the clients about the changes, presumably. The final regulations came out in January, just as tax season got underway. I've warned people somewhat that, remember, all of us who were doing the updates at that point, we had very little time to go from reg issued to doing the core sessions before tax season got started. We had, you know, we were trying to do those things. They came out in mid to late January. I did my first session on them basically 1 week after they came out. And we had other sessions coming shortly after that. Probably the latest sessions came in mid-February. So at most, somebody who's prepping for that had 3 to 4 weeks to get materials ready. 3 weeks probably to get materials ready. So mechanically, everybody was rushed and we had to put things together quickly. So there wasn't a lot of time to digest. So even though we went through guidance there and talked about what was happening, you do realize it was a bit of a rush. And, you know, some of you may not have taken courses on the final regs. And that also makes it kind of interesting going out. And because the guidance came out so late, we've had major problems during tax season because our tax software just is punting on many issues. And those problems continue through today. I expect that next year your software is going to be very different in how it deals with 199 Cap A. This year, they found out the final rules effectively the same time we did there in late January. That means they, while I was putting together, trying to put together courses and teach courses over those 3 weeks before we got to February 15th, when the 1099 consolidateds drop and suddenly tax season is really underway, they just had those 3 weeks to actually try to get systems running to calculate the 199 Cap A deductions under what they now discovered were how the regs were going to work. So we had issues all through tax season on that. The final regulations, we still have some key issues that we've had there that people ran into all year. Remember, probably the biggest problem all through tax season I saw on discussion groups related to dealing with rentals. Rentals, are they a trade or business? We got and we'll talk about this briefly, the safe harbor, the proposed revenue procedure, which has a safe harbor, which we were allowed to use. But people confused, was that the only way to qualify? And I think the answer very clearly was no. And then they also tended to confuse combining different rentals together for enterprises in the safe harbor with the question of aggregation. Under the regulations, the two are not the same. The two are not really related at all, but it's a problem. And it wasn't helped by the fact that our software also quite often was not set up to properly handle that. So in many cases, people found that, okay, understand the rules. We have basically a partnership here, you know, and the partnership owns 12 rentals, but it's really one operation. They run a bunch of rentals all throughout, you know, a metro area. So it's a single trader business. It may still be 12 activities for the passive loss rules because activities are not trader businesses. We were told that in the regulations, but their software had no good way of allowing them to report 12 activities, but report one single trader business aside from aggregating, which actually isn't the way you're supposed to do it. Because if you're aggregating, then, and let's say, and they said, you know, if we can treat all these 12 as an enterprise, we meet the safe harbor. And they might have been concerned if they didn't meet the safe harbor, well, is it not a trader business? I wouldn't have been too concerned about that, but people were. And again, you can't aggregate until they are a trader business. So we had lots of fun over that aggregations. We also had real issues all tax season with pass-through calculations and how they interact with limitations or issues at the entity level issue. The regulations tell us pretty clearly that, you know, something, in fact, the law tells us that something cannot be part of QBI unless it enters into the calculation of taxable income for that year. But the proposed regs tell us, you know, that the partnership or S-corp basically computes a QBI number and they hand that to the equity holder. Well, we don't really have clear guidance on how we do the limitations based on what was passed out from the partnership, because the partnership doesn't really tell us what makes up their QBI. So it's been a mess all year. And that includes areas like, for instance, suspended losses due to basis, at risk, passive activity rules. How do we determine how much of the QBI from different activities got suspended? We have the 1231 gain or loss problem. Remember, if the partnership passed out a 1231 gain, the regs tell us a 1231 gain, if it's taxed as capital gain, is not part of QBI. If it's not taxed as capital gain, it's ordinary income because of, let's say, 1231 recapture, then it is QBI. Well, the partnership has no idea if it will or won't be taxed as capital gain. That whole determination is not made until the partner's return or the S-Corp shareholders return. The shareholders return. You know, how do we handle that? Software all year was kind of, you know, had issues in that area. And it had, as I mentioned earlier, the problem of conflating activities and trader businesses. The regulations make it very clear those two are not the same thing. But the software had no good way of saying we have 12 activities, but one trader business. According to the software, and by the way, the regulations also make it fairly clear that they think it's very difficult to have more than one trader business in an entity. But they also make it very clear to the 469 regulation for passive losses that you can easily have multiple activities in the same entity. But our software and I don't know if any software, I have not heard yet of any software that separately was able to deal with TOBs versus activities for things like rentals, where you could combine 12 rentals into a single TOB, but not treat them as, you know, and do that, not necessarily doing it for the safe harbor, but still have 12 activities for purposes of 469. And again, kind of been a problem all year. We've been battling that all year and no good way around it. We do still have some proposed regs in play. We did have proposed regs issued on mutual funds and how QBI would impact that. Can they pass through? And the funds have been operating on those proposals if they were the real thing, because we don't have much other choice. But we had to worry about that issue. You know, can they pass through? If a mutual fund holds something that kicks out QBI, how do we handle that? Those were released in January, right? They have not yet made it to OIRA. So those proposed regs are still proposed. Again, we would assume they may be aiming for January 22nd, but it's not clear, or I should say June 22nd. That one may be difficult because they came out awful late to make that June date. We'll have to see. Remember the rental safe harbor I mentioned? Please remember that is a proposed revenue procedure, which means that a final revenue procedure will be issued this year, and it means it may change. So you need to be aware of that. Watch out for that coming forward. We also do not yet have proposed regulations on Section 199 Cap AG. That is for agricultural cooperatives. The proposed regs were sent to OIRA late in tax season. So they should be coming out the next few months. Now, the reason why I think the IRS felt they could hold these is because Congress made it very clear when they passed this fix for the grain glitch that the IRS should issue regulations on this that are like the old 199s, because for all practical purposes, 199 Cap AG is really the old 199 section that got repealed, just simply picked up in whole and dropped in here and said, cooperatives, ag cooperatives, go ahead and use this. We're going to go ahead and use this, reference this for you to be working on. So that gives them something to work on. Those, again, are at OIRA. Future guidance in 199 Cap 8, what we're mainly done, we're in regs. The IRS made it very clear. I said already, we're going to have less sub-regulatory guidance, so we're not going to have as much in the way of revenue rulings and notices. Do not expect that. We may see, I think, one thing the IRS could do is issue more safe harbors, like the rental one. The problem I have with that is it tends to confuse issues because a lot of people read safe harbor to mean the only way it can work. Safe harbor is merely that. It is, if you do this, the IRS will not challenge your treatment. But if you have a different fact pattern that doesn't fit this case, then, you know, you may still qualify for whatever that you're trying to qualify for. Again, but don't be surprised to see more safe harbors. A safe harbor would fit in the sub-regulatory guidance. It's the IRS's position what they will do administratively. And generally, it'll be a safe harbor that will get the taxpayer the result they want, but the taxpayer is not required to make use of it. So we may see that. We'll probably see a lot more non-binding guidance. Don't be surprised with all the questions occurring if people try to go for private letter rulings in various special cases. So we may need to watch those PLRs on 199 Cap A issues. The IRS may internally issue a lot more of internal memos, like chief counsel advices on the issue. Again, so that unofficial guidance, you may need to watch that this year. Again, it gives us some idea of how Treasury will move. Similarly, we may see the IRS position outlined when they write their instructions or publications. Again, those aren't binding. You can disagree with them, but it will tell us what it is. Now, remember, that's the problem with either one of these is they're not binding on the IRS either. And the catch is you can use them to protect yourself from penalties, but you can't really use them to force the IRS to follow their position. So you have to kind of agree with their logic. That said, normally you're pretty good if you follow one of those. We're going to get court cases on these various issues because the court cases are going to come up. You know, we're going to start seeing as disputes arise in various areas, we're going to see court cases come out over the next few years. So be aware of that. There's a lot of stuff here that just simply is not clear. But you still got to file returns, you make decisions. One thing to remember, and this is all throughout the TCJA, filing a return requires normally a binary choice. Either you treat it as A or you don't treat it as A. There's a binary choice. But nothing says that there is a clearly correct binary answer. Should it be A or should it be B? Is there an absolutely correct answer out there? Basically, under your fact pattern, until and unless the Supreme Court hears your case, the answer is probably no. There is not necessarily an automatic. If we're in these fuzzy areas, we're going to be dealing with uncertainty. That uncertainty will continue. As we get court cases, we'll start to narrow that uncertainty a bit. We'll get a lot more comfort. But that's going to take years for that to happen. Also, be very aware that we have things the IRS told us in the final regulations were out of scope in the preamble. Like, what about partner unreimbursed partner expenses? What about issues related to, state income taxes on the business income? Does that affect it? Oh, yeah, you probably thought about, wait a minute, I never even thought that affected it, but we have those issues. Again, out of scope questions, interest on acquiring a pass-through interest. Does that affect QBI? Remember, the IRS didn't tell us yes or no. The IRS just said it was outside the scope of the regulations to make that decision. Again, it raised the obvious question, what regulations was it inside the scope of? But we don't know. Those issues will continue to dog us over the next year. And actually, over the next few years, to be totally honest, we'll see how things work. Again, on returns, we have to take positions on those issues. So you need to be ready for it. The other next biggest thing we had in discussions online are the interest under 163J for interest deductions for business interest. We do have proposed regulations on this. I am very certain the IRS is going to try to get this one through by the June 22nd date. It's not yet clear when the finals will appear. They've not gone to OIRA yet, but the June 22nd date deadline being there suggests they probably should end up there in the near future. If you are outside of pass-throughs, I think the main concern has been raised by the proposed regs was it had a very expansive definition of what's interest expense. We'll see if the final regulations, if the IRS backs off that. There's been a lot of comments from people complaining that it was too broad, that what they called interest, which was then going to be used for the test, and if you had too much of it, you're going to lose it and have to carry it forward till you no longer have too much interest. We'll see if the IRS backs off that broad definition. I am not sure how they'll react to that. Certainly got a lot of criticism for it, but I also think they feel that people are going to try to play game, shall we say, or try to game the system or try to call something a little different just to try to get out of these limits. So I kind of understand why they have a super broad view of it. But again, that's going to be your big impact if you're working for, let's say you're in the tax part of a large C corporation. But if you're in pass-throughs, which is where I think a lot of the issues are hitting those people listening to this broadcast, there the problem is the provisions are rather complicated. And there are major distinctions between how this impacts partnerships and S-corps. And I mean by complicated, I mean just allocating excess business income in a partnership involves, as I recall, a 13-step calculation that goes on for pages in the regulations to explain how to do it. Now, good news, bad news for this past filing season. The big issue was all of that complex stuff primarily deals with issues that will come up when we have care, as when we try to deal with the carryovers. We may be computing the amount they get for next year's carryover, or we may be computing the amount that they could then use, or at least help use, against other carryovers. But those all, you know, are part of the calculation going forward. The final regs will tell us if they can simplify that, if they change it. Again, they mentioned that, you know, you could read the law to say partnerships and ESSA should have the same treatment, you know, and they wanted comments on whether they were okay doing with this. They thought it could be read both ways. They went with differences. So it's possible if they decide to get the same treatment, one of the two could have a radically different result. We get to the final reg. So you're going to want to watch this one carefully. And definitely, you got a partnership on extension right now who has 163J issues. I would certainly leave them on extension until June 22nd. The other big question under these regs that will impact those below $25 million is, do they give us any sort of safe harbor or out from the syndicate rules? Do they give us any kind of way to assure we're not a syndicate? Remember, if you're a syndicate, even though your average revenue is below $25 million, you have to report 163J limits. And remember, syndicates tell us that more than 35% of the losses go to limited entrepreneurs. And limited entrepreneurs, you got to keep following the bouncing ball for the definitions here, are those who do not materially participate in the activity and are insulated essentially from loss. So a lot of real estate partnerships would be syndicates. You know, if you strictly applied that definition, is the IRS going to force such a strict use of definition? We'll have to see. But, you know, the law talks about the syndicates don't get this. Depreciation, that one's actually pretty simple where we're at there. We don't like it. The real question there is, when are they going to fix the retail glitch? Remember, we're supposed to get 15-year, which then allows us to take bonus depreciation, which is 100%. On qualified improvement property, but Congress fouled up. They tried to simplify the qualified improvement rules. We had three categories. They wanted to go to one, and they did that whole neat simplification. That's great, except, of course, when they simplified it, they forgot to put the life back in, and so it defaulted 39 years. Everybody agrees it's a glitch, but here's the catch. It did not get fixed last year, right? Was not fixed as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. You know, we knew this one basically when it came out of conference. It was pointed out this error was there, but at the time they didn't want to stop the train. And, you know, because you know, they had barely enough votes in the Senate to pass this thing. And, you know, if you go back, you start changing things again, everything's back on the table. And, you know, well, we still have the votes to pass it if we do that. So, you know, they didn't feel like they could touch it. It didn't get fixed with the grain glitch. You know, the grain glitch is much more serious. And it's pretty clear now there's been a change in control of the House. And it certainly appears that the House is not going to pass this without some pay-fors. In essence, you've got to pay for the money that's going to be lost by allowing them to do the rapid write-offs. The problem with that is, of course, it's always complicated to find an acceptable way to pay for something. You know, we're finding odd ways. Obviously, raising penalties appears to be the big thing that people are finding to use for pay for. So if you're not aware, the IRS, you know, this new IRS reform package that went through the House and maybe going through the Senate here when they get back into town, you know, we're going to raise again the penalty on late filing a partnership in S Corp, raise it up, I think, about another $100 per partner or S Corp shareholder per month. So, you know, that's where they find some of this stuff. This is going to be a bigger find, and it's not clear where they'll get it. And that means just finding one that even the Democrats would vote for in the House, you know, ignore the fact of how we get it through the Senate. So my guess is we'll eventually get the retail glitch fixed, but it's going to be probably a long process. This one may not be fixed by the time you have to file those returns in September 15th, even on extension. Don't necessarily, I mean, we'll hope it, but don't know. Proposed regs came out early. The IRS had promised the final regulations early in 2019, but we are still waiting on those. We have not seen them. So we'll have to see. I think the IRS was hoping that this retail glitch should be fixed and they could put some proposed regs in there to deal with, you know, how to deal with this property and picking it up as bonus depreciation. That probably doesn't appear to happen. If they want to meet the June 22nd deadline, they probably won't have time to get that in. One that we are having guidance coming out here soon is state and local tax deduction issues. Remember, proposed regulations on state tax credits were issued this past summer. We had a clarification issued by the Treasury Secretary shortly after we got the regs issued that was meant to assure people that it didn't change the treatment of business deductions. Unfortunately, people in states that already had existing credits read that to mean, oh, great. So what I'll do is I'll take that charitable contribution for the private school tuition donation, and I'll just pay it out of my S corporation or out of my C or out of my proprietorship. And I'll go back to those old cases that we used to worry about in C corps. We tried to say something was really advertising or promotion type expenses instead of charitable contributions, because charitables had a 10% and still have a 10% taxable income limit for corporation, but advertising and promotion don't have those limits. So everybody started trying to work down that path and thinking, well, that's how we're going to do it. That's a workaround. That's how the 33 states already had this rule, you know, already had increased credits that were total that were up to total wipeout of the tax credit. You know, you basically make a $1,000 contribution, you get a $1,000 reduction in your state tax. Don't believe that you do that? Come to Arizona. That would work. Well, late in the year, we got some news people weren't so thrilled about. Revenue Procedure 2019-12 kind of killed that. In essence, that revenue procedure told us that, we meant what we said, but here's what's going to happen. If, in fact, that state tax credit reduces the income taxes of the owner, you know, of the shareholder, then you do have to offset regardless of what it is. If it is a C corporation, then no, don't worry about it. So wonderful for C corps, but I don't think anybody cared about that. So this is a problem that was issued. The final regulations went to OIRA. Now, they are there. Again, late in tax season, they went to OIRA. So we got them there. They did not come out there. But interestingly enough, they also sent along a related document for OIRA to review. So, you know, that's been raised as to, well, we wonder what that document is. You know, my guess is it came, the IRS was planning to issue a revenue procedure with this or something of that sort or some other sub-regulatory guidance. Then internally, they decided we're not going to do sub-regulatory guidance anymore. So now they're trying to issue something else with it. We'll have to see how that works. But those final regs should be coming out. If you're in a state that has a state tax credit, you know, you want to take a look at that, see what changes, if any, got made and whether that could impact your federal returns that are on extension. My guess is there may be some liberalization, but I suspect there won't be much. I don't think there's much they can do without putting at risk the ability to shut down programs that were clearly meant to just be the pure workaround. Because, frankly, some of the other programs get awfully close to looking like pure workarounds, even some of the existing ones. So we have to be careful there. And by that, I do not mean giving $200 to get, you know, maybe for private school tuition. I'm talking about, you know, get what we had here, like in Arizona, the unlimited private school tuition. Well, you had to get your bid in. And, you know, there was a total cap statewide, but no per cap taxpayer cap. That in essence, you could give as much as you want that organization, offset your state taxes dollar for dollar. Well, that was a way to wipe out your state tax entirely, even if your state tax was hundreds of thousands of dollars, which would have been a great workaround. My guess is it's very difficult for the IRS to allow for the prior credits without opening the door wide, because you have to define what's the limit there. Is it okay to give $1,000 to a private school, but it's not okay to give $500,000, but then where's your dividing line? And again, we're not, you know, I don't think they want to get into that. And I think if they did, it would automatically mean tell them immediately we would get those credits back in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut, among other states, that would give us the offset. Now, Treasury's been making noises about, and this is kind of the issue going, you know, some states have done entity-level taxes. Connecticut was the first to start with that. Wisconsin almost got it in. They got it in, but was signed a set of bills that now a court in Wisconsin have just declared null and void based on the state constitution. However, that's being appealed. So we don't know if Wisconsin has entity-level tax or not. We're still kind of waiting there. But the IRS has announced, you know, that they wanted to quash the entity-level workarounds, but they haven't really told us how they're going to do it. And that's interesting because they told us they're going to quash the other thing too, you know, by using a method they didn't end up being able to use. So again, the entity level workarounds are going to be interesting. Again, I'm worried about some, again, just like with the credits, some pre-existing taxes that may get caught up in this. For instance, the California S corporation tax on gross revenue, that very well could get caught up in this entity level tax problem. There's also the question of what's the scope of the 212 activity exception to the limitation. We don't really know that at this point. Other big issue coming up, you know, that annual, the business loss limitation under section 461. We have no regulations at all to date on this. All we have is the form. And that form doesn't agree with the blue book, are wages business income or not? That's also a problem. Remember, under this rule, you can only deduct no more than $250,000 of net business losses on an individual return per year, or $500,000 if it's a joint return. Again, if wages are business income, that would allow the losses to, you know, they'd be part of that net calculation. If they're not, they won't. Blue Book says they're not. The Form 461 instructions say they are. The AICPA had a concern regarding the instructions to say a trade or business talked about you having to actively be part of it yourself. And they're saying, well, that's not required anywhere. So, you know, that really should be changed. That's inconsistent with everything else. So we may see a change in that. I think that comment probably will be picked up because it is inconsistent with everything else. But we also have a whole series of carryover issues. If you have a loss disallowed, it says it becomes an NOL. Well, then that raises the question, is the NOL next year subjected again to the business income loss rule? Or is it just a one-time only limitation and next year it becomes an NOL that's just subject to the 80% taxable income rule? We're not sure. We have nothing on this year, no regs, nothing except the instructions, and the instructions don't have to deal with that because nobody has 461 losses carrying into, you know, NOL, 461 NOLs carrying into 2018. So it wasn't a problem for them. Other areas, I want to mention this quickly. We still don't know the answer to excess deductions on terminations. Notice 2018-61 talked about a lot of things with trusts and getting deductions, but it did raise the question that the IRS is not sure about how excess deductions on terminations of a trust or estate should be treated in the individual return. Traditionally, the IRS has always treated those as 2% itemized deductions. And remember, that's the default for any itemized deduction. But now you realize only things that aren't 2% could potentially be in that category. And now, you know, the question becomes, well, could Congress really have meant to kill that deduction on the individual side? And now some people are saying, oh, the AICPA sent a letter pointing out that the only reason they're 2%ers is because the IRS put in instructions years ago, but there's never been any formal guidance in the area. And the AICPA then argues we should try to look into that, kind of like we do DNI, to figure out what makes up those excess deductions. We have no real answer. We were told in the K-1 instructions, you're kind of indicated, you're told, oh, put that in line 16 of Schedule A, which would be other miscellaneous deductions, which really aren't miscellaneous deductions. We get that out of the tax law. It's kind of a weird definition, but we had to call them something on Schedule A. But in essence, they're the ones we'd get, like the gambling losses. But the Schedule A instructions tell you very clearly that you can only take on that line the specific things listed in the Schedule A instructions for that line, and excess deductions and terminations aren't listed there. So it's like the Schedule A instructions and the instructions on the K-1 are in conflict with each other. The IRS is a bit, you know, kind of, they're split personality time. We don't know how to handle it. We also still have a whole mess with opportunity zone regs. We did have some proposed regs get out, but we're missing whole sets of them. New proposed regs are being reviewed by OIRA, but the catch is the clock's running on getting into these. What's happening now, there's a write-up in tax notes this week about, you know, a program that was set up in one case where the company just went in and they're hoping that their interpretations of the opportunity zone rules is going to be what the IRS agrees with because they need to get this thing running. So it's kind of a mess. We also don't have yet anything except a threatened regulation on the carried interest rules. And the loophole there, if you put your carried interest in a partnership into an S corporation, form an S corporation, give your partnership interest to that. By the way, the law literally reads, you don't have to worry about that 3-year holding period for carried interest, carried partnership interest. Treasury said they're going to shut that down, but we haven't seen regs yet, and I'm not sure it's going to be easy to shut down without technical correction. So what there should be a takeaway from, there's a whole lot going to happen this year, a lot going on. So gets us to our standard thing here that our state society sponsors will like. Now's the time to get looking at registering for your 2019 CPE. First, to catch up on what happened while tax season was going on. to actually get now without the rush and just trying to cram it and do something, maybe now take a time to take a look at how 199 cap-based final regulations really, really work and what maybe we can do with those. Take a look at the other issues. Remember, we've got all these areas we talked about here today that are going to be changing this year because we're going to get guidance. We're going to get pieces coming out. Things are going to be really happening. This is a year where I think having something live, either in person or a really live broadcast webinar, can be very, very helpful. And your state societies have lots of these available for you to register for. Their catalog should be out now. It's time to register for CPE. We should arrive. I know Arizona traditionally has tried to time their catalog to drop on our desks here on the 16th, and all of us have our offices closed, so the mail doesn't get delivered today. But hey, you know, when we show up next, it'll show up. I'm sure your other states, I know most states have their online versions of the catalogs up and running, so you go select things, go check out the courses, and get ready for this year, because there's going to be a lot to learn and a lot happening. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 16th. Next week, we'll return to our standard, looking at what actually happened in cases, rulings, etc. for the week. You can catch our updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, send to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter account, @edzollers, as I write things up on the site, I'll post things there. I also follow discussions. I've noted this before. I follow the Connect groups on the Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota Society of CPAs. I also follow California Society, Tax Talk, their Yahoo groups for the California Society. And I follow on Reddit. I'll try to look in from time to time to the /r/taxpros site. So get information there. If you have questions, those groups are really good to bounce things off of, especially if you're a sole practitioner. You just need somebody to bounce an idea off of. Those are good places to bounce things around. Make sure you check in there. Otherwise, like I said, take some time off, recover, have a good week, and then come back here next week. We'll see you here on Current Federal Tax Developments.